Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When today's guest, Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht, graduated from medical school, he chose psychiatry, believing it would be the area of medicine that would evolve and grow the most in the following decades. Over his 40-year career, he has worked in many settings, including VA medical centers, university clinics, community mental health clinics, homeless centers, and private practice. In his new book, My Brother's Keeper, The Untold Stories Behind the Business of Mental Health and How to Stop the Abandonment of the Mentally Ill, he writes, quote, "Everywhere I worked, despite the promise we'd sensed in the 1960s and 70s, it felt like we were falling behind in our battle against mental illness. During the latter part of the 20th century and early part of the 21st, there have been no major breakthroughs in our understanding of these brain diseases, nor major advancements in their pharmacological treatments as had been anticipated. In fact, the most effective drugs we have for major psychiatric disorders, like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, are now more than 50 years old. He says, in many ways, we're now providing worse care for patients by treating with medications alone instead of offering more comprehensive treatment interventions. Dr. Rosenlicht explains why we maintain this healthcare system that we loathe so much and ways we can turn it around. He writes, "Let's back up and look at why we built this system and what needs it serves. Only then can we implement real solutions. Every other developed nation has managed to modify their healthcare systems in ways that have resulted in higher quality and more cost-effective care. We can too." Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht is clinical professor at the UC San Francisco School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. He has more than 40 years of clinical, research, administrative, and teaching experience. He's held faculty member positions at the UCLA School of Medicine, UC Davis School of Medicine, and the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. Now it's the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht has authored more than 30 peer-reviewed publications, and his new book is My Brother's Keeper, The Untold Stories Behind the Business of Mental Health and How to Stop the Abandonment of the Mentally Ill. Hi, Dr. Rosenlicht. Thank you so much for your many years of work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, one of the arguments that you make in your book is that this system is working exactly as it was designed to work.
Well, exactly. There's a number of points I like to make that people either say mental illness isn't real or it's not treatable or that our system is broken or would cost too much. All of these points are false. We have set up a healthcare system, and it's really true of all medical care. It's just that mental health is the worst case example, where the incentives are for corporations whose bottom line is the goal. Care is something to be charged and doled out as it is profitable. But our goal is not people's good health. As a matter of fact, companies often make more money when people remain sick. And it's just doesn't serve us. It's serving these entities which were designed to make money. And unfortunately, they make money on our illness.
And we'll talk about how we got to that place. You also write about the incredible changes that we have seen over the years. By the 1960s, you write, we had a medicine chest full of relatively effective drugs for a number of formerly hopeless psychiatric disorders like depression, bipolar disorder, and even schizophrenia, with the promise of newer and better treatments on the way. So can you talk about that? Because that's one of the reasons why you decided when you were in medical school to choose psychiatry.
Exactly. I thought I was entering a field that was going to change the most in the next few decades. As you said, we had these new medicines, which after years of not being able to treat these disorders, we actually could limit and symptomatology, and sometimes even help people get over their disease. And we had new techniques in neural imaging, which was going to unlock the brain. We had the decade of the brain. We had advances in psychotherapy from beyond the, more rigid paradigm of psychoanalysis, branching into object relations theory, self-psychologies, CBT, and integrating these interventions that all showed great promise. And in putting together these comprehensive ways of treating people, we all thought that things were going to get much better and new treatments were going to come out. Unfortunately, this just hasn't been borne out, because what took place is following the dollar, not the health.
And you're right, and this is important to also recognize and emphasize, because many of us have direct experience with mental illness, and many of us have seen the benefits of drugs or therapy. You write, "I saw patients so depressed they could not rise from their bed or eat, who were literally starving to death, get up, begin talking again, eat, and go home to productive lives." And I mentioned to you in an email before the show that I have a loved one who, right before COVID, really spiraled into a very deep depression. She spent about 90% of her day in bed. And it was just shocking to see this happen overnight. It was so hard to find her help. And we can talk about that later in the show. But at the end of the day, we were able to find a nurse practitioner. It was very hard to find a doctor or a psychiatrist who takes Medicare. And she just really, I guess, I don't, what is the word we use? She tried different drugs. She had no experience with these drugs and found something that actually worked for her. If you met her today, you'd never know that this happened to her. And there are other stories like this. Not everyone is so lucky. But so these drugs do work. But as you say, we haven't seen many benefits since when these drugs first came out. And that's pretty shocking to think about.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad you're a good story, and there are good stories, but this, for every good story, there's five bad ones. People who can't access care, or basically get crappy care, where the medicine is thrown at them, and without any explanation of a dose adjustment, or this might be the right one, or there may be side effects, or withdrawal when you come off. And these people are just left to their own. And if they don't immediately get better, they're out of luck. And the other thing is that you are talking about this story throughout history. I mean, we've othered those with mental illness. It's very scary to think that we're not, well, as Michel Foucault put it, that people cannot get a grip on their inner lives. This threatens who we are. And when I go to parties, people go, "Oh, you're a psychiatrist, ha ha ha." And I get teased a little bit. Well, that must be really hard. There's something called courtesy stigma that goes along with being a psychiatrist or a therapist. But they will call me the next day, or they will corner me by the coat closet and say, "Hey, listen, can you give me some help?" We all act like this is something that doesn't affect us. Who do you know who does not have a relative, a friend, a friend's kid, or somebody who has been seriously affected by mental illness? I mean, seriously, or by a drug overdose or substance abuse. It affects us all, but we somehow pretend it's not our problem. We walk in the city and step over bodies or around feces, or see these people, trying to cook a meal on a street corner, and we shake our head. And what can we do as an individual? But we just pretend that it doesn't affect our lives. It's just amazing, our ability for denial.
Or you open your book with the example of the experience you had on BART. And those of us who live in the Bay Area, we've all had this experience. Well,
Absolutely.
you were on BART, and there was a visibly deranged man screaming obscenities and threats at people on the train. We've all experienced this. And most people don't know what to do. They're afraid to do something. And then people get angry. I mean, you hear people talk about this issue all the time.
Well, and I can't blame people. I don't want to come off that I don't get angry. I hate this. I don't want to go downtown. It's ugly. And you should not confront somebody who's ranting and raving. We can get into later the whole Jordan Neely, Daniel Penny, the guy who got strangled on the New York subway. and he was viewed as a hero. It's awful. It's ugly. And you don't want to put yourself in danger. But this isn't an individual response. This should be a societal response. But our society behaves in terms of care, in terms of view, that these people are not part of society. And they're somehow, they're weird, they're geniuses, they're bizarre, but they're dangerous and weird. They're not. By and large, these are us. These are people who are suffering from an illness, a treatable illness that requires care, comprehensive care. But we need to make a decision as a society that it's worth caring for them, because it is. It's tearing apart our sense of community. And it really does start at the top. I mean, healthcare is the largest lobbying industry in our country and the biggest supporter of federal candidates. So the laws that we have that would allow us to treat these people or institute true care just doesn't happen, because financial incentives take precedent. It's time for us to realize that it's not worth the cost.
Talking about how many of us are affected by this, you bring up so many statistics in your book. A 2023 Gallup poll found that rates of depression in the United States are skyrocketing, with more than 1 in 6 Americans say they are currently depressed or receiving treatment for depression. 29% report that they've been diagnosed with depression at some point in their life. And then these stats are also just devastating. In 2022, we lost roughly 300,000 people to suicide, excessive alcohol use, and overdose, more than to AIDS, guns, and motor vehicle accidents combined. This is more than we lost to COVID, which was 244,000 people, which dominated the news and public discussion. And Dr. Rosenlicht, this is so devastating. Suicide is now the second most common cause of death in 10 to 24-year-olds in this country, behind only accidents.
Well, absolutely. And those statistics just say it all. During the whole of the pandemic, 2020 to 2024, which just overturned our society, caused all sorts of divisions. We may have set our kids way behind with the way we shut down schools. And I understand the financial implications of these bailouts equaled the cost of the Great Depression. Yet during those 4 years, more people died of suicide, overdose, and alcohol than died of COVID. And yet something like around 4.4% of healthcare insurance dollars are towards mental illness. I mean, we spend a pittance. We can go over it more later, but you know, it used to be that we had this network of asylums across the country, and it was the government supposedly taking care of mental illness, and it was a horribly overcrowded system, and it wasn't even adequate. 1 in 2 beds in this country were for psychiatric illness, and it was horribly overcrowded. And now we're going to spend 4.4% of our dollars taking care of these illnesses. The fact is, visits to psychiatrists are paid out of pocket 15 times more often than those visits to a primary care doctor. Why is this? It's because if you have the money, you can buy your way in. The trouble is, most people can't. And what do? They suffer and die. Right. Major mental illness is associated with about a 10 to 20 year loss in life expectancy. Yet we treat these illnesses like they're not real or they're not actually medical care. So far as it's so threatening to call somebody a psychiatric patient, we don't even call that. We call them clients, as if it's a business deal, which of course makes it easier for insurers to deny care or not keep records confidential, because after all, these are business clients and they're not medical patients, which you have a responsibility to. We treat it as a business deal, not as something that affects us all. Yet it's estimated that untreated mental illness costs us billions a year. And, we look at, whether these companies are making a profit or not, but we're not looking at what the overall cost to us as a society is.
On today's Your Call, we're spending the hour with Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht. We're talking about his new book, My Brother's Keeper, The Untold Stories Behind the Business of Mental Health and How to Stop the Abandonment of the Mentally Ill. Dr. Rosenlicht is clinical professor at the UC San Francisco School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. He has more than 40 years of clinical research, administrative, and teaching experience. He's worked at VA medical centers, university clinics, homeless centers, private practice, and community mental health clinics. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Rosenlicht, any questions about mental health, if you or a loved one has experienced depression or a mental health condition, we'd love to hear from you. And then the other issue about what we can do about our people who are living on the streets that we see every day in the Bay Area and other cities across this country. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Rosenlicht, you're bringing back memories of when I tried to get help for my loved one, and it was so incredibly difficult. I couldn't find a psychiatrist who takes Medicare. We went to so many therapists and it just didn't help. And you think, okay, I'll pay out of pocket a few times, but what if I have to keep going because it does? I mean, there's just so many factors involved. Who do I call? What's the difference between a therapist, a psychologist, and a psychiatrist? I didn't know that back then. It's just really difficult to navigate, and I'm a pretty good researcher. So what would you say to people? We'll first talk about people who are dealing with mental illness, and then we'll talk about the larger issues of, you know, how to get people on the streets the help they desperately need. People who are dealing with this, or maybe a loved one is dealing with depression, where do they even begin?
Well, that's the problem. There's all sorts of systemic barriers put up to avoid your utilizing care, which costs the company's money. Or if you're very wealthy, you get sucked into these incredibly expensive private resort-like treatment centers, which charge, you know, up to $100,000 a month. Mm-hmm. So basically, you pay or you're out of luck. In terms of, let's start with your comment about finding a psychiatrist. These insurers have what are called ghost networks, which are supposed lists of practitioners who are on their insurance panel. The trouble is many of them aren't, or they're full. And there have been several studies showing that after calling everyone twice, they can even contact maybe 25% of them and maybe get an appointment with half that number. I get calls every day and my practice is full. Around 50% of psychiatrists take any form of insurance. Most of them don't. And most of them will not take your insurance. And these things are deliberately opaque. Now, when you say you work, you know, you're on an insurance panel, you make it sound like this is a benefit. And it may seem that way from the patient side, but to sign up to be a quote in network, it means you're signing a contract that you had no part in negotiating. You're taking an amount of money, which is usually less than I pay my plumber or my auto mechanic, to get specialized care from somebody with over 8 years of post-college training for treatment. And when the person walks in the door, you don't know if they really have that insurance. You don't know if they've met their deductible. You don't know if they've exceeded their limit. You don't know if they're still on the plan. You don't know if you're going to be reimbursed or when. That you may have to do what's called a prior authorization, which is filling out forms for the insurance company to then deign to pay for the treatment. And the treatment will, more than in any other area of medicine, have restrictions on the time and treatments you may use. Throughout my medical career, I don't mind staying up late at night working with patients. I do resent spending the evening filling out forms. And these forms are just set to make it difficult for patients to access care. Your questions are totally valid. Our Byzantine system, for example, what is a therapist? What is a counselor? What is a psychiatrist? You know, the brain, the most complex organ in our body, as opposed to your tooth, your skin, your liver, it's the only organ that our healthcare system has treated by master's level therapists. This is somebody with a 2-year degree as opposed to an 8 years of training. Why is it that the mind has some, you know, we allow them to be treated independently by somebody without a medical background. The therapists I know, the MFTs generally, they are really good. They are really dedicated. And if it weren't for them, people would not be getting any care. But why do we have this double standard? And again, we call them clients because it's just so threatening to call somebody a patient. Although, again, I have to ask, like, what's the difference between an in client and an out client? It's sort of saying that, oh, they're not that sick at all. And I think that's why we do it, is so that somebody feels like, oh, I'm not that sick. I'm not really psychiatric ill. I don't need a psychiatrist. I can go for therapy light. But then how do you find somebody? According to the Bureau, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average hourly payment for a master's level therapist, like an MFT, is $24. Mm. So you're going to put yourself through a generally private school for 2 years and do 2,000 hours of clinical supervision to get paid $24 an hour. A medical bachelor's level nurse gets paid 50% more. So of course these people, like psychiatrists, are going to say, forget it. I can't make a living at this. I'm going to take somebody who can pay out of pocket. And basically then that means folks who don't have phenomenal family resources or don't have great insurance are just out of luck. And if they get care, it's going to be a 15-minute visit to throw a medicine at them or throw them some sort of survey kind of or a cookbook kind of therapy and expect them to get better. This is just nonsense. And I also have to point out, like, mental health has been the canary in the coal mine. These sort of tricks have worked so well on people with mental illness and their families because of the shame. And, you know, who's going to advocate and fight against an insurance company, somebody with mental illness who can't even make it, you know, on the streets? Mm. These techniques have worked so well that now they've now expanded to other areas of medical care. If you've ever tried to get any kind of specialist in the last couple of years, we're all suffering now with this great model that was pioneered by mental health care. Mm. I kind of went on here. I'm sorry, Rose, but maybe bring me back to a more specific.
No, I appreciate it. This is real. And you really need an advocate because it takes so much effort just to try to get appointments, like you said, to try to be seen, to figure out if this particular drug
basically
works or not.
You know, if you can get into care, it shows you're not ill. I mean, it takes that sort of effort. It shows you're neither ill nor poor. And what happens in our model is that, you know, the poor get sicker and the sick get poorer. It causes these great disparities because, you know, you have to be wealthy and well-connected to be able to access care.
Mm. Well, we have a caller who would like to share her experience. So let's hear from Jennifer in San Francisco. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. This is a subject that is near and dear to my heart and also frightening. My mother, I have been her advocate. She's had severe mental illness for decades, plus a plethora of others. And what this gentleman just stated a few seconds ago, getting her an appointment is an effort. And I feel like Sisyphus. It's just, I can't tell you how many times they said, well, in 4 months, we can get her in for a brief evaluation. And or that's not my subject, or and or well, I can prescribe some medication, but I said you haven't even seen her. And I'm curious, and I know this is a subject that's been going on for a long time. Is there any hope of not fixing, but making it so that people who have issues like you've been describing and what I've been living easier and more manageable and not so daunting? Because yes, the mind is a powerful tool that dictates and dominates every other part of your body,
right?
Illness and otherwise. And I could go on, but I won't. It's because you're familiar, all of us are familiar with this.
Yes, Jennifer, thank you. I'm so sorry to hear about your mom. And really just, we're going to continue doing shows because of knowing that you're listening. We have to keep talking about these issues. What are your thoughts, Dr. Rosenlicht?
Well, I'm really sorry, Jennifer, and I wish I could say I've never heard that story before. Yours is the rule rather than the exception. And, you know, there's several points in on how do you access care. Like if you go to a therapist, you're going to get therapy occasional or what you can pay for. You go to a psychiatrist, you're going to get a 15-minute med visit. Neither of these works so well alone. It's clear that you know, comprehensive care where you may have therapy, you may have support, you make sure you have housing, you make sure you have income. These things are all needed for someone to really be able to recover. You know, mental illnesses are no different than any other chronic illnesses in terms of their need for care. You know, you wouldn't give somebody with diabetes a week of insulin and then send them on their own and send them home a dietary sheet. These, you know, chronic illnesses are chronic. They need care and they need, people need to have recovery. But we don't do that for mental illnesses. You know, I have a patient, a wonderfully wise woman, who came to me, was incredibly upset about an adult child, a brilliant young man, who had developed a severe refractory depression. And she was just freaking out. And then after a while we were talking, she realized she had another child who had insulin-dependent diabetes. And that certainly was a tragedy, and she handled it well. But the difference in feeling about mental illness, that, oh, no, this isn't a chronic illness we can manage, there's something really wrong and shameful here, it's the way we approach this. And getting back to your initial point, we are the only developed nation that does not have universal health care. This is a horrible shame. We have a lower life expectancy by 5 years of other developed nations. Countries, and a lot of this is due to mental illness and substance use. Why do we allow this? It's because we're allowing the profit. Why have not we instituted universal care? Now, since we have these individual operators who are all working for their market share and dollar, trying to get better mental health care is basically like whack-a-mole. It really doesn't work. Even the Affordable Care Act, which have the number of uninsured that's in this country is great, serve to more further entrench the business interests that lock up how we get health care. Health care should be a right. We don't, you know, not, we look at it, how well is it making money, or is it paying for itself? Do we ask that of our fire department? Is your fire department making money? Is your sewer system making money? These are needs, not wants. Why do we put a financial price on it and allow people to make money on this? I think, you know, the big answer there, Jennifer, is we need universal care, and mental health should not be separated from physical health. I mean, if you call up your healthcare provider, you know, they'll be, if you're having an emergency, call 911, you know, if you're having a psychiatric or a medical emergency. The reason they ask it is because if you're having a medical emergency, they're going to send paramedics. If you're having a psychiatric problem, they're going to send the police in most cities. Mm-hmm. We treat mental illness differently. It's a separate clinic. It's a hospital set out in the boonies where people aren't shamed by looking at or seeing it. We should be getting and giving care to everyone in an integrated setting. So there's not the shameful of, are you a client or are you a patient? It's just part of maintaining the health. I mean, people who have mental illness have physical illness. People who have physical illness have mental illness. You can't separate the two. In fact, there was a study, a 25-year study at Kaiser that looked at primary care visits. 60 to 90% of the visits were prompted by a psychosocial event. Not their underlying illness, but it was psychosocial reasons that they went to their primary care doc. Mm-hmm. Separating out this just doesn't make any sense. And I think it's time we talk to our legislators and say, no, we need universal health care, which will save us money, and we need to integrate mental and physical care. Why? There's supposedly parity, but I mean, United Health, even Kaiser, have been shown again and have been sued for providing minimal resources for those with mental health. We just can't separate out, is it your brain or is it your body? That doesn't work. There's a really funny quote that I have in the book I like to use by Oscar Levant, and he was a humorist from the 50s, and he was apparently a known hypochondriac. He said, I went to see my doctor. He told me my trouble is all in my head. What a terrible place for it to be. Mm. Why are we separating this? Why do you get sent to a different clinic? Why do we have different benefits? if it's your mind or your body. It's never all one or the other.
Well, thank you for calling in, Jennifer, and we're sending our best wishes to you and your mom, and we will definitely continue to do these shows. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht, clinical professor at the UC San Francisco School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. Over his 40-year career, he's worked in so many settings, including VA medical centers and community mental health clinics. He's out with a new book, My Brother's Keeper: The Untold Stories Behind the Business of Mental Health and How to Stop the Abandonment of the Mentally Ill. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about the Trump administration's power grabs and Project 2025. Democracy Forward has filed so many lawsuits to challenge things like the reorganization of the federal workforce and to stop efforts to gut library services. They're also filing FOIA requests to uncover the scope of unlawfully stripping Americans of their citizenship. And they say they've had several court victories so far. We hope you can join us for that tomorrow. On the Media Roundtable, we'll talk about the human toll of Trump and Musk's massive, massive budget cuts. And then we'll speak with the New York Times' Eric Lipton about his piece, Secret Deals, Foreign Investments, Presidential Policy Changes, The Rise of Trump's Crypto Firm. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. He's author of the new book, My Brother's Keeper: The Untold Stories Behind the Business of Mental Health and How to Stop the Abandonment of the Mentally Ill. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Parker in San Francisco. Hi, Parker. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you, Dr. Rosenlicht, for your career. I just wanted to share some of my own experiences trying to navigate therapeutic services. I have switched insurances multiple times, which has caused most therapists to drop me or to, you know, abandon after just a few sessions. I've had a therapist before let me know that basically because of the hassle they were experiencing with insurance, they no longer were going to be able to provide services for me, and instead switch over to a private insurance. I can't afford those out-of-pocket costs. And so I guess I just wanted to share that and also ask, I was just seeing Daniel Lurie talk about, you know, new proposals to basically get people off the streets through police force, through bringing people and lowering their amount of shelter. I guess what I'm wondering is, how do we kind of combat the apathy that I feel like a lot of people have around some of these issues? I think we talked about that experience that you have on BART and seeing people who are clearly struggling with mental issues. A lot of people just simply don't want to experience or witness that and are unwilling to pursue something more comprehensive. So I kind of wonder, in the face of sort of, I think, like a moral apathy, how do we kind of combat that and go beyond just that, I suppose?
Great question. Thank you so much. Dr. Rosenlicht?
Yeah, well, I certainly sympathize and empathize and feel the same way as you. It's easy to get beaten down by this. Like, what is an individual going to do? And that's why I think it starts at the top, that we really need systemic change where our society, that's why I titled the book Brother's Keeper. It's in our interest to view this as a community problem. It makes it ugly to go downtown. It makes us want to stay in our house. It makes us not want to care about these people because what can an individual do? And honestly, there is very limited amount an individual can do. These people often need comprehensive care. And even for more minor cases, like throwing a few sessions of psychotherapy or medications, doesn't work. When you're rebuilding a life after, you know, an emotional breakdown, it really takes more than a few pills or a few sessions. I mean, it takes rebuilding your sense of yourself. But our society just doesn't acknowledge that it's a problem or acknowledge that it can be done. In 1963, as we were closing down the asylums, President John Kennedy, his last law he signed before he was assassinated, this is Halloween of 1963, was the Community Mental Health Centers Act, which was to set up community mental health centers in the community with comprehensive services to provide those who are having mental illness problems. You know, they were never adequately funded. They became inadequately staffed by undertrained people who didn't know how to handle serious illnesses. And so now, instead of having 500,000 Americans in a hospital, we have about that number of mentally ill people in prisons. Other countries have borrowed that model. Franco Basaglia, an Italian psychiatrist in the 60s, spent 6 months seeing these centers that Kennedy set up. And he imported the model over to Trieste, Italy, where they have community centers with peer supervisors. They house people. They give them jobs. There's very few people who can't do some sort of job and add to the community. And their rate of hospitalization is minimal. Their cost compared to ours, minimal. These people are incorporated in society instead of leaving people like you and I feeling like, what can I do for this? We need to fundamentally change the way we handle. You know, this is part of our community. These people are our brothers and sisters and kids and parents. Why are we allowing our society to basically cast them off as useless? We all get our sense of our who we are and feeling good about ourselves is really most dependent on how we're caring for others, not how we're caring for ourselves. And I do worry about a lot of the wellness stuff in our society now and mindfulness, which is all about making me feel better. Lasting satisfaction in our life is generally about taking care of others. So I would advocate, get involved with like NAMI or one of the organizations advocating for universal health care. So it becomes a goal of our society to not to push these people out so we avoid them, but rather we embrace them. We would just feel better if we felt like these people were adding to society. There are very few people who can't do something to be part of society. And all but the really most crazy among us do want to be part of society and feel like we're adding. I don't know why our country, you know, follows this rugged individual mentality that you got to make it on your own or screw you. It's not working for us. So I would strongly recommend to work for universal health care and get in touch with an organization like NAMI. It's the National Alliance for Mental Illness. There's National Single Payer. There's NHMH, which is No Health Without Mental Health. Get involved with one of these organizers and write your legislators. They are lining their pockets with healthcare and mental health care corporations' dollars while we suffer.
Well, and also to hear about Parker's experience, and I'm sure so many people can relate to this, when you change jobs, you have to change insurance providers. And then all of a sudden, the person that maybe you have a great connection with doesn't take your new insurance.
Well, absolutely. And that's this whole thing about calling people providers as if like the relationship is interchangeable. You know, you give up. Every time there's one of these barriers you got to jump over, you change jobs or the insurance company changes or you have to fight for benefits. You know, we all can fight for a while and then we give up. Why do we have to be fighting for healthcare? It's our money. It's our lives. Why is this an adversarial business relationship instead of a collaborative care relationship? Why did we let it get defined that way? The CEOs of major healthcare corporations, their average salary is $30 million a year. Why are we paying these people like that, yet therapists get paid an average of $24 an hour? Why? On hospital boards, the majority on hospital boards come from the financial industry. Something like one in six board members on major hospitals come from the healthcare industry. Why are our decisions being made by dollars, not by what makes us healthy?
Well, thank you again for the call, Peter. We have so many emails and phone calls coming in, Dr. Rosenlicht, which just speaks to the importance of this issue. Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht is clinical professor at the UC San Francisco School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. His new book is My Brother's Keeper: The Untold Stories Behind the Business of Mental Health and How to Stop the Abandonment of the Mentally Ill. I out of respect for our listeners, why don't we take a few calls? I'll read some emails, and then we'll get your final thoughts. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let's go to Tina in Oakland. Hi, Tina. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks, Rose. It's so fantastic to have you back and addressing this extremely important thing. I have been volunteering with FASME, which is Families Advocating for the Seriously Mentally Ill. And while we were giving testimony before the Alameda County Board of Supervisors, I saw that what it would cost the Alameda County $12 million for six SIX psychiatric beds.
Wow.
As I understand it, the Hospital Corporation of America controls these prices to lease beds. So we rely on jails to get medical care for a significant disease. Anyone with SMI, serious mental illness, as usual, going through anosognosia, which is a lack of insight to their illness, like with a stroke, don't pass the requirements for a 5150 when the police address a crisis. And the police and any social worker will tell you it isn't illegal to have a mental illness, but that's how we treat it, and they have to commit a violent crime to get help. Oh. I'm wondering if the doctor, who has now become a personal hero in the last 45 minutes, would address the costs of hospital beds, if that number is true, and what he thinks the help with Prop 1 and trying to address the gravely disabled to get 5150s across, if he has any words on that, because that's the big issue. We can't get 5150s from the police.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Tina. It sounds like this would be a good show. We're going to take a few more callers, and then we'll get Dr. Rosenlicht to respond. Let's hear from Wayne and Elsa Bronte. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Rose, and thank you, Dr. Lichtenstein. I've really been absorbed and appreciative of all of your comments, especially in terms of calling out the true disease in the room, namely late-stage chronic capitalism. Mm-hmm. My own experience I want to share is, you know, with my own mental health, had to do with my wife. She has she's 5.5 years with stage 4 cancer, mm-hmm. and the only reason we're in falling down a black hole is actually two reasons. One is my friends, and the other is a free service called the Cancer Support Community. So they allowed me to get to meet with other people in exactly the same shoes, you know, people who are primary caregivers of late-stage cancer late-stage cancer patients, and talk. And there's no limit. I stayed in that group for a year and a half. Every week we get to talk together, and it's kind of saved my life. So I just want to call out the whole social side of getting out of the money system and into the social, you know, friend, free service, volunteer networks. Mm. Thank you.
Wayne, how is your wife doing?
Not well. She's very ill.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Wayne, and the Cancer Support Community. We'll definitely look that up. I think right now it's so important to do shows about this just to share resources. Thank you, Wayne, thinking of you and your wife. Let's go next to Peter in Florida. Hi, Peter. Thanks for holding.
Hi. Thank you. Here's the question I have, just because I'm looking at the world in various ways and saying, what is the line between mental illness and personality disorder? Like, and I'll tell you, I'm thinking about my brother. I've seen him long enough since I was a kid, you know, and he's just been a jerk his whole life. And I'm like, wait a minute, maybe it's a mental illness. And everything from, and let me throw out the word paraphrenia, because I looked up as a diagnosis for President Trump. I was looking at it, it's like, could he be given a diagnosis of paraphrenia? I mean, if you look up the definition on the internet, it's like, that describes
Peter,
President Trump.
Sorry, we're almost out of time. What question do you have for Dr. Rosenlicht? You want him to talk about the line between mental illness and personality disorder?
Personality disorder. Should I be telling my brother, go get medication, go see it, or should I just keep writing him off as a jerk? You know what I mean? When does he graduate to like a medical treatment?
Well, oh gosh, thank you, Peter. Let's take two more callers and then we'll get responses. I know these are big questions, but I want to make sure we hear from everyone. Let's go to Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Rose. I think you reported a while back that you had a good experience with a telehealth service called Total Life.
Yes.
I was wondering if your guests can talk about the effectiveness of telehealth, because there's a lot of these new agencies, I don't know what you want to call them, popping up, and they have figured out how to take insurance. And that telehealth is making mental health much more accessible. I'm a psychologist, and I have found telehealth to be very effective for allowing me to reach more people.
Yes, Total Life. It's totallife.com. I found this for a loved one. They take Medicare and a number of other insurance providers, including Cigna, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aetna. And you can either even do it on the phone because it's mostly for elders. In fact, it is for older adults. And not every older adult knows how to use telehealth. And so they will also call you on the phone, totallife.com. Dr. Rosenlicht, there's a lot of big questions there, but what are your thoughts? I'm noticing that a lot of new services are coming on, just like Chris said, telehealth services that do take insurance. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, this is like, I mean, many aspects of the industry is that they're very good billers. Mm. And I'm really glad about your experience with Total Life. And there are good people doing some good work. There's also big problems. The number of stimulants that were being handed out like candy, and they're not lawsuits by some of the telehealth corporations. And for example, even BetterHealth, which is advertised widely on NPR, they are a corporation, they sold people's private data, including their diagnosis and their medications, to Facebook and other corporations to make money. Hmm. That these are businesses. There's been also you know, a lot of scandals about supposedly the therapist. There's like a whole slew of them with the same name to make it seem like you're getting the same care. Oh, wow. It can be done well. And the idea of having telehealth so it can reach people at home is great. But I worry often about the implementation of it and why people have to turn to it. There's no question. I mean, I do telehealth and I can reach people who are homebound. A lot of people are more comfortable in their home. I can see what their home environment's like. It's a little bit like the old psychoanalyst, having somebody comfortable on the couch and not feeling so exposed. There are real benefits to it, but it goes back to the old problem. When money is the motivator rather than health, that worries me. Mm-hmm. So there's the good in there and there's the bad, and how do we sort them?
And then we have about 2 minutes left. What are your thoughts on Peter's question?
At what point
should he possibly talk to his brother about getting help? I'm sure a lot of people have questions like this.
Okay. Actually, one more thing on Chris that, you know, the seriously mentally ill living in homeless camps and, you know, on the streets, their internet access to telehealth companies isn't so good. So they're not getting care.
Right.
This question about what is an illness, I mean, it's so at the core of who we are. Well, actually, somebody who really has a personality disorder is considered to have a mental illness. And the way it's generally defined, and I think what works is it causing the person significant dysfunction in their capabilities and functioning in life, or considerable distress. And this is the whole thing. Is it somebody, a client or a patient, are they ill or not? Why are we making this distinction? Why are we saying, is it physical or mental, or is it a mental illness? Why don't people come into care? I mean, if somebody has bronchitis, do they not get care unless it becomes pneumonia? I would approach the brother and say, listen, I'm concerned about you. I think your behavior is bothering me. I think you need help, but you can't force them to get help. And that will then tie into Tina's issue. And I go for it, Tina. I support FASME, get involved with that. But we don't treat mental illness generally unless it causes criminal behavior, like they want to hurt somebody else or themselves, or they're so dysfunctional they can't care for themselves and they disrupt the society. This was meant to protect the mentally ill, but Lanterman, who was part of the Lanterman Petras Short Act in California, which has served as the model, he was horrified about what his law became, that instead of protecting people from overreach in government, it provided a means for insurers to refuse to care for people unless they were behaving like criminals. Our three largest inpatient psychiatry facilities in this country are Rikers Island Prison, Cook County Jail, and LA County Jail. Our three largest psychiatric hospitals are jails and prisons. Why do we treat criminality but not suffering? This should just be part of our healthcare, Peter. And I mean, talking to your brother saying, listen, I'm worried about, the way you're limping. I'm worried about the way you're behaving. Could you please talk to somebody? All you can do is reach out as a member of that person's world.
Well,
Dr.
Rosenlicht, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we would love to have you back because we got so many emails we didn't have time for. So we hope you'll come back soon. Dr. Nicholas Rosenlicht is author of the new book, My Brother's Keeper. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.